browsed greedily. The juncture of the road was marked by a great paved circle, surrounded by open grassy meadow with another monolith at its center. I would have expected it to be crowned with moss and scarred by lichen. Instead, the black stone was smooth and clean, save for dust deposited by wind and rain. I stood staring up at the stone, studying the glyphs, while the fool wandered about. I was wondering if any of the markings on this one matched the markings I had copied to the map, when the fool exclaimed,
"There was a village here once."
He gestured wide with his hands. I glanced up and saw what he meant. There were indentations in the meadow where stunted grass cloaked old, paved walkways. A wide, straight way that might have been a street once ran through the meadow and off beneath the trees. Moss and vine-shrouded upthrusts were all that remained of cottage and sharp walls that had lined it. Trees grew where once hearths had burned and folk had dined. The fool found a large block of stone and climbed upon it to spy in all directions.
"It might have been a sizable town at one time."
It made sense. If this road had been the highway for commerce that I had seen in my skill-seeing, then it was only natural that a town or market would spring up at every crossroads. I could imagine it on a bright spring day, when farmers brought fresh eggs and new spring greens to town, and weavers hung out their new goods to tempt the buyers, and, for half an instant, the circle about the pillar thronged with folk. The vision began and ended at the pavement stones. Only within the virtue of the black stone did the people laugh and gesture and barter with one another. A girl crowned with a twist of green vine came through the crowd, glancing back over her shoulder at someone. I swear she caught my eye and winked at me. I thought I heard my name called and turned my head. Upon a dais stood a figure dressed in a flowing garment that shimmered with the glint of gold thread. She wore a gilded wooden crown, decorated with cunningly carved and painted rooster heads and tail feathers. Her scepter was no more than a feather duster, but she gestured with it royally as she issued some decree. In the circle about me, folk roared with laughter. I could only stare at her ice-white skin and colorless eyes. She looked right at me. Starling slapped me hard. My head snapped on my neck with the force of her blow. I looked at her in astonishment, blood pooling in my mouth where my teeth had cut my cheek. She lifted her clenched fist again, and I realized she had not slapped me. I stepped back hastily, catching her wrist as her fist went by. "Stop it!" I cried angrily.
"You stop it!" she panted. "And make her stop it, too!"
She gestured angrily to where the fool perched still upon his stone, frozen in artful mime of a statue. He did not breathe nor blink, but as I watched, he slowly toppled over, falling like a stone. I had expected him to change it to a handspring in mid-fall, to come flashing to his feet as he so often had when he amused King Shrewd's court. Instead, he measured his length in the meadow grass and lay still. For a moment, I looked stunned. Then I raced to his side. I seized the fool under the arms and dragged him away from both the black circle and the black stone he had climbed upon. Some instinct made me take him into shade and lean him back against the trunk of a live oak. "Get water!" I snapped at Starling, and her scolding and fluttering ceased. She ran back to the loaded jeppas and got a water skin. I put my fingers alongside his throat and found his life pulsing steadily there. His eyes were only half-closed, and he lay like a man, stunned. I called his name and patted at his cheek until Starling returned with the water. I unstoppered the skin and let a cold stream of it spatter down over his face. For a time there was no response. Then he gasped, snorted out water, and sat up abruptly. His eyes were blank. Then his gaze met mine, and he grinned wildly.
"Such a folk, and such a day! It was the announcing of Rielda's dragon, and he had promised he would fly me."
He frowned suddenly, and looked about in confusion.
"It fades like a dream, it fades, leaving less than its shadow behind."
Kettle and Ketriken were suddenly with us as well. Starling tattled out all that had happened while I helped the fool to drink some water. When she was finished, Ketriken looked grave, but it was Kettle who lashed out at us.
"The White Prophet and the Catalyst," she cried in disgust. "Rather name them as they are, the fool and the idiot. Of all the careless, foolish things to do. He has no training at all. How is he to protect himself from the coterie?"
"Do you know what happened?" I demanded, cutting into her tirade.
Well, of course not, but I can surmise. The stone he clambered on must be a skill stone, the same stuff as the road and the pillars. And somehow this time the road seized you both with its power instead of just you."
"Did you know it could happen?" I didn't wait for her reply. "Why didn't you warn us?"
"I didn't know,"
she retorted, and then added guiltily,
"I only suspected, and I never thought either of you would be so foolish as to—"
"Never mind,"
the fool cut in. Abruptly he laughed and stood up, pushing away my arm.
"Oh, this! This is such as I have not felt in years, not since I was a child. The certainty, the power of it. Kettle, would you hear a white prophet speak? Then hearken to this and be glad, as I am glad. We are not only where we must be, we are when we must be. All junctures coincide. We draw closer and closer to the center of the web. You and I."
He clasped my head suddenly between his two hands and placed his brow against mine.
"We are even who we must be."
He freed me suddenly and spun away. He launched the handspring I had expected earlier, came to his feet, curtsied deeply, and laughed aloud again, exultantly. We all gawked at him.
"You are in great danger,"
Kettle told him severely.
"I know,"
he replied, almost sincerely, and then added,
"as I said, exactly where we need to be."
He paused, then asked me suddenly,
"Did you see my crown? Wasn't it magnificent? I wonder if I shall be able to carve it from memory."
"I saw the rooster crown," I said slowly, "but what to make of any of this I do not know."
"You don't?"
He cocked his head at me, then smiled pityingly.
"Oh, Fitzy Fitz, I would explain it if I could. It is not that I wish to keep secrets, but these secrets defy telling in mere words. They are more than half a feeling, a grasping of rightness. Can you trust me in this?"
"You are alive again," I said wonderingly. I had not seen such light in his eyes since the days when he had made King Shrewd bellow with laughter.
"Yes," he said gently, "and when we have finished, I promise that you will be also."
The three women stood glaring and excluded. When I looked at the outrage on Starling's face, the rebuke in Kettle's, and the exasperation in Ketriken's, I suddenly had to grin. Behind me the fool chuckled, and try as we might, we could not explain to their satisfaction exactly what had happened. Nevertheless, we wasted quite some time in attempting it. Ketriken took out both maps and consulted them. Kettle insisted on accompanying me when I took my map back to the central pillar to compare the glyphs on it to the ones on the map. They shared a number of marks in common, but the only one that Ketriken recognized was the one she had named before. Stone. When I reluctantly offered to see if this pillar might not transport me as the other one had, Ketriken adamantly refused. I am ashamed to admit. I was greatly relieved.
We began together, and I intend that we shall finish together,
she said darkly. I knew she suspected that the fool and I were keeping something from her.
What do you propose, then?
I asked her humbly.
What I first suggested. We will follow that old road that goes off through the trees. It appears to match what is marked here. It cannot take us more than 2 marches to reach the end of it, especially if we start now.
And with no more announcement than that, she got up and clicked to the Jeppas. The leader came immediately, and the rest obediently fell into line behind her. I watched her long, even strides as she led them off down the shady road.
"Well, get along, both of you,"
Kettle snapped at the fool and me. She shook her walking stick, and I almost suspected she wished she could prod us along like errant sheep. But the fool and I both fell obediently into line behind the Jeppas, leaving Starling and Kettle to follow us. That night, the fool and I left the tent's shelter and went with Night Eyes. Both Kettle and Ketrigan had been dubious as to the wisdom of this, but I had assured them I would act with all caution. The fool had promised not to let me out of his sight. Kettle rolled her eyes at this, but said nothing. Plainly, we were both still suspected of being idiots. But they let us leave anyway. Starling was sulkily silent, but as we had not had words, I assumed her pique had some other source. As we left the fireside, Ketrigan said quietly,
"Watch over them, Wolf."
And Night Eyes replied, with a wave of his tail. Night Eyes led us swiftly away from the grassy road and up into the wooded hills. The road had been leading us steadily downward into more sheltered country. The woods that we moved through were open groves of oaks with wide meadows between. I saw sign of wild boars, but was relieved when we did not encounter any. Instead, the wolf ran down and killed 2 rabbits that he graciously allowed me to carry for him. As we were returning to the camp, by a roundabout path, we came on a stream. The water was icy and sweet, and cress grew thick along one bank. The fool and I tickled for fish until our hands and arms were numb with the cold water. As I hauled out a final fish, its lashing tail splashed the enthusiastic wolf. He leaped back from it, then snapped at me in rebuke. The fool playfully scooped up another handful and flung it at him. Night Eyes leaped, jaws wide, to meet it. Moments later, all 3 of us were involved in a water battle. But I was the only one who landed bodily in the stream when the wolf sprang on me. Both fool and wolf were laughing heartily as I staggered out, soaked and chilled. I found myself laughing also. I could not recall the last time I had simply laughed aloud about so simple a thing. We returned to camp late, but with fresh meat, fish, and watercress to share. There was a small, welcoming fire burning outside the tent. Kettle and Starling had already made porridge for our meal, but Kettle volunteered to cook again for the sake of the fresh food. While she was preparing it, Starling stared at me until I demanded,
"What?
How did you all get so wet?" she asked.
"Oh, by the stream where we got the fish. Night Eyes pushed me in." I gave him a passing nudge with my knee as I headed toward the tent. He made a mock snap at my leg.
"And the fool fell in as well."
"We were throwing water at one another," I admitted wryly. I grinned at her, but she did not smile. Instead, she gave a small snort as if disdainful. I shrugged and went into the tent. Ketrigan glanced up at me from her map, but said nothing. I rucked through my pack and found clothes that were dry, if not clean. Her back was turned, so I changed hastily. We had grown accustomed to granting one another the privacy of ignoring such things.
"Fitzchivalry,"
she said suddenly, in a voice that commanded my attention. I dragged my shirt down over my head and buttoned it.
"Yes, my queen?"
I came to kneel beside her, thinking she wanted to consult the map instead. She set it aside and turned to me. Her blue eyes met mine squarely. "We are a small company, all dependent on one another," she abruptly told me. "Any kind of strife within our group serves the purpose of our enemy." I waited, but she said no more. "I do not understand why you tell me this," I said humbly at last. She sighed and shook her head. "I feared as much, and perhaps I do more harm than good to speak of it at all. Starling is tormented by your attentions to the fool." I was speechless. Ketrickin speared me with a blue glance, then looked aside from me again. "She believes the fool is a woman, and that you kept a tryst with her tonight. It chagrins her that you disdain her so completely." I found my tongue. "My Lady Queen, I do not disdain Mistress Starling." My outrage had rendered me formal. In truth, she is the one who has avoided my company and put a distance between us since finding that I am witted and sustain a bond with the wolf. Respecting her wishes, I have not pressed my friendship upon her. As to what she says of the fool, surely you must find it as ludicrous as I do. "Should I?" Ketrickin asked me softly. "All I can truthfully say I know of it is that he is not a man like other men." "I cannot disagree with that," I said quietly. "He is unique among all the people I have ever known. Cannot you show some kindness to her for chivalry?" Ketrickin burst out suddenly. "I do not ask that you court her, only that you do not let her be rent with jealousy." I folded my lips, forced my feelings to find courteous answer. "My queen, I will offer her, as I ever have, my friendship. She has given me small sign of late of even wanting that, let alone more. But as to that topic, I do not disdain her, nor any other woman. My heart is given already. It is no more right to say that I disdain Starling than it is to say that you disdain me because your heart is filled with my Lord Verity." Ketrickin shot me an oddly startled look. For a moment, she seemed flustered. Then she looked down at the map she still gripped. "It is as I feared. I have only made it worse by speaking to you. I am so tired, Fitz. Despair drags at my heart always. To have Starling moody is like sand against raw flesh to me. I but sought to put things right between you. I beg your pardon if I have intruded. But you are a comely youth still, and it will not be the last time you have such cares."
"Comely?"
I laughed aloud, both incredulous and bitter.
"With this scarred face and battered body?
It haunts my nightmares that when Molly next sees me, she shall turn aside from me in horror.
Comely."
I turned aside from her, my throat suddenly too tight to speak. It was not that I mourned my appearance so much as I dreaded that Molly must look some day on my scars.
"Fitz,"
Ketrickin said quietly. Her voice was suddenly that of a friend, not the queen.
"I speak to you as a woman, to tell you that although you bear scars, you are far from the grotesque you seem to believe yourself. You are, still, a comely youth, in ways that have nothing to do with your face, and were my heart not full with my Lord Verity, I would not disdain you."
She reached out a hand and ran cool fingers down the old split, down my cheek. As if her touch could erase it, my heart turned over in me, an echo of Verity's embedded passions for her, amplified by my gratitude, that she would say such a thing to me.
"You well deserve my lord's love,"
I told her artlessly, from a full heart.
"Oh, do not look at me with those eyes,"
she said dolefully. She rose suddenly, clasping the map to her breast, like a shield, and left the tent. 30. Stone Garden. Dimity Keep, a very small holding on the coast of Buck, fell shortly before Regal crowned himself King of the Six Duchies. A great many villages were destroyed in that dread time, and there has never been a true count made of all the lives that were lost. Small keeps like Dimity were frequent targets for the Red Ships. Their strategy was to attack simple villages and the smaller holdings to weaken the overall defense line. Lord Bronze, to whom the keep of Dimity was entrusted, was an old man, but nonetheless, he led his men in defending his small castle. Unfortunately, heavy taxation for general coastline protection had drained his resources for some time, and Dimity Keep's defenses were in poor repair. Lord Bronze was among the first to fall. The Red Ships took the keep almost easily, and reduced it with fire and sword to the rubble-strewn mound that it is today. Unlike the Skill Road, the road we traveled the next day had experienced the full ravages of time. Doubtless, once a wide thoroughfare, it had been narrowed by the encroachments of the forest to little more than a track. While to me it seemed almost carefree to march down a road that did not at every moment threaten to steal my mind from me, the others muttered about the hummocks, upthrust roots, fallen branches, and other obstacles we scrambled through all day. I kept my thoughts to myself, and enjoyed the thick moss that overlaid the once cobbled surface, the branchy shade of the bud-leafed trees that overarched the road, and the occasional patter of fleeing animals in the underbrush. Nighteyes was in his element, racing ahead and then galloping back to us to trot purposefully along beside Ketrickin for a time. Then he would go ranging off again. At one time he came dashing back to the fool and me, tongue lolling, to announce that tonight we would hunt wild pig, for their sign was plentiful. I relayed this to the fool.
"I did not lose any wild pigs, therefore I shall not hunt for any," he replied loftily.
I rather agreed with his sentiments. Burrich's scarred leg had made me more than wary of the great tusked animals. "Rabbits," I suggested to Nighteyes. "Let us hunt rabbits."
"Rabbits for rabbits,"
he snorted disdainfully, and dashed off again. I ignored the insult. The day was just pleasantly cool for hiking, and the verdant forest smells were like a homecoming to me. Ketrickin led us on, lost in her own thoughts, while Kettle and Starling followed us, caught up in talk. Kettle still tended to walk more slowly, though the old woman seemed to have gained stamina and strength since our journey had begun. But they were a comfortable distance behind us when I quietly asked the fool, "Why do you allow Starling to believe you are a woman?" He turned to me, waggled his eyebrows, and blew me a kiss.
"And am I not, fair princeling?"
"I'm serious," I rebuked him. "She thinks you are a woman and in love with me. She thought that we had a tryst last night."
"And did we not, my shy one?"
He leered at me outrageously. "Fool," I said warningly.
"Ah," he sighed suddenly. "Perhaps the truth is I fear to show her my proof, lest ever afterwards she find all other men a disappointment."
He gestured meaningfully at himself. I looked at him levelly until he grew sober.
"What does it matter what she thinks? Let her think whatever is easiest for her to believe."
"Meaning?"
"She needed someone to confide in, and for a time chose me. Perhaps it was easier for her to do that if she believed I was a woman also."
He sighed again.
"That is one thing that in all my years among your folk I have never become accustomed to, the great importance that you attach to what gender one is."
"Well, it is important," I began.
"Rubbish," he exclaimed. "Mere plumbing, when all is said and done. Why is it important?"
I stared at him at a loss for words. It all seemed so obvious to me as to not need saying. After a time I said, Could you not simply tell her that you are a man and let the issue be laid to rest?
That would scarcely lay it to rest, Fitz,
he replied judiciously. He clambered over a fallen tree and waited for me to follow.
For then she would need to know why, if I am a man, I do not desire her. It would have to be either a fault in me or something I perceived as a fault in her. No, I do not think anything needs to be said on that topic. Starling, however, has the minstrel's failing. She thinks that everything in the world, no matter how private, should be a topic for discussion, or better yet, made into a song. Ah, yes!
He struck a sudden pose in the middle of a forest trail. His stance was so artfully reminiscent of Starling when she readied herself to sing that I was horrified. I glanced back at her as the fool launched into sudden, hearty song.
Oh, when the fool pisses, pray tell, what's the angle? Did we take down his pants, would he dimple or dangle?
My eyes darted from Starling to the fool. He bowed, an embroidery of the elaborate bow that often marked the end of her performances. I wanted at once to laugh aloud and to sink into the earth. I saw Starling redden and start forward, but Kettle caught at her sleeve and said something severely. Then they both glared at me. It was not the first time that one of the fool's escapades had embarrassed me, but it was one of the most keenly edged ones. I made a helpless gesture back at them, then rounded on the fool. He was capering down the path ahead of me. I hastened to catch up with him. "Did you ever stop to think you might hurt her feelings?" I asked him angrily.
"I gave it as much thought as she gave to whether such an allegation might hurt mine."
He rounded on me suddenly, wagging a long finger.
"Admit it! You asked that question with never a thought as to whether it would hurt my vanity. How would you feel if I demanded proof that you were a man? Ah!"
His shoulders slumped suddenly, and he seemed to lose all energy.
"Such a thing to waste words on. With all else we must confront, let it go, Fitz, and I will as well. Let her refer to me as she, as much as she wishes. I will do my best to ignore it."
I should have left it alone. I did not. "It is only that she thinks you love me," I tried to explain. He gave me an odd look.
"I do."
"I mean, as a man and a woman love." He took a breath.
"And how is that?"
"I mean, it half angered me that he pretended not to understand me. Forbidding. For—"
"And is that how a man loves a woman?"
He interrupted me suddenly.
"Forbidding?"
"It's a part of it." I felt suddenly defensive, but could not say why. He arched an eyebrow at me and said calmly,
"You are confusing plumbing and love again."
"It's more than plumbing!" I shouted at him. A bird abruptly flew off, cawing. I glanced back at Kettle and Starling, who exchanged puzzled glances.
"I see," he said.
He thought a bit as I strode ahead of him on the path. Then, from behind me, he called out,
"Tell me, Fitz, did you love Molly or that which was under her skirts?"
Now it was my turn to be affronted. But I was not going to let him baffle me into silence. "I love Molly and all that is a part of her," I declared. I hated the heat that rose in my cheeks.
"There, now you have said it,"
the fool replied, as if I had proven his point for him.
"And I love you, and all that is a part of you."
He cocked his head, and the next words held a challenge.
"And do you not return that to me?"
He waited. I desperately wished I had never started this discussion. "You know I love you," I said at last, grudgingly. "After all that has been between us, how can you even ask?" "But I love you as a man loves another man." Here the fool leered at me mockingly. Then a sudden glint lit his eyes, and I knew that he was about to do something awful to me. He leaped on top of a fallen log. From that height, he gave Starling a triumphant look and cried dramatically,
"He loves me, he says, and I love him!"
Then, with a whoop of wild laughter, he leaped down and raced ahead of me on the trail. I ran my hand back through my hair and then slowly clambered over the log. I heard Kettle laughing and Starling's angry comments. I walked silently through the forest, wishing I'd had the sense to keep my mouth shut. I was certain that Starling was simmering with fury. It was bad enough that lately she had almost no words for me. I had accepted that she found my wit something of an abomination. She was not the first to be dismayed by it. At least she showed some tolerance for me. But now the anger she carried would have a more personal bite to it. One more small loss of what little I had left. A part of me greatly missed the closeness we had shared for a time. I missed the human comfort of having her sleep against my back, or suddenly take my arm when we were walking. I thought I had closed my heart against those needs. But I suddenly missed that simple warmth. As if that thought had opened a breach in my walls, I suddenly thought of Molly and Nettle, both in danger because of me. Without warning, my heart was in my throat. I must not think of them, I warned myself, and reminded myself that there was nothing I could do. There was no way I could warn them without betraying them. There was no possible way I could reach them before Regal's henchmen did. All I could do was trust to Burrich's strong right arm and cling to the hope that Regal did not truly know where they were. I jumped over a trickling creek and found the fool waiting for me on the other side. He said nothing as he fell into pace beside me. His merriment seemed to have deserted him. I reminded myself that I scarcely knew where Molly and Burrich were. Oh, I knew the name of a nearby village, but as long as I kept that to myself, they were safe.
What you know, I can know.
What did you say? I asked the fool uneasily. His words had replied so exactly to my thoughts that it sent a chill up my spine.
I said what you know, I can know,
he repeated absently. Why?
Exactly my thought. Why would I wish to know what you know?
No, I mean, why did you say that?
In truth, Fitz, I've no idea. The words popped into my head and I said them. I often say things I have not well considered.
The last he said almost as an apology. As do I. I agreed. I said no more to him, but it bothered me. He seemed, since the incident at the pillar, to be much more of the fool I remembered from Buckkeep. I welcomed his sudden growth in confidence and spirits, but I also worried that he might have too much faith in events flowing as they should. I also recalled that his sharp tongue was more prone to bear conflicts than resolve them. I myself had felt its edge more than once, but in the context of King Shrewd's court, I had expected it. Here, in such a small company, it seemed to cut more sharply. I wondered if there were any way I could soften his razor humor. I shook my head to myself, then resolutely dredged up Kettle's latest game problem and kept it before my mind, even as I clambered over forest debris and sidestepped hanging branches. As late afternoon wore on, our path led us deeper and deeper into a valley. At one point, the ancient trail afforded a view of what lay below us. I glimpsed the green-beaded, trailing branches of willows coming into leaf, and the rose-tinged trunks of paper birches presiding over a deeply grassed meadow. Beyond, I saw the brown-standing husks of last year's cattails deeper in the vale. The lush rankness of the grasses and ferns foretold swampland as surely as the green smell of standing water did, when the ranging wolf came back, wet to his flanks. I knew I was right. Before long we came to where an energetic stream had long ago washed out a bridge and devoured the road to either side of it. Now it trickled, shining and silver in a gravelly bed, but the fallen trees on either bank attested to its flood-time fury. A chorus of frogs stilled suddenly at our approach. I went rock to rock to get past it with dry feet. We had not gone far before a second stream crossed our path.
Given a choice of wet feet or wet boots, I chose the former. The water was icy. The only kindness was that it numbed my feet from the stones in its bed. On the far side, I put my boots back on. Our small company had closed its ranks as the trail grew more difficult. Now, we continued to march silently together. Blackbirds called, and early insects hummed.
"So much life here,"
Ketrikin said softly. Her words seemed to hang in the still sweet air. I found myself nodding in agreement. So much life around us, both green and animal. It filled my wit sense and seemed to hang in the air like a mist. After the barren stones of the mountain and the deserted skill road, this abundance of life was heady. Then I saw the dragon. I halted in my tracks and lifted my arms out in a sudden gesture for both stillness and silence that all seemed to recognize. All of my companions' gazes followed mine. Starling gasped, and the hackles on the wolf stood up. We stared at it, as unmoving as it was. Golden and green, he sprawled under the trees in their dappled shade. He was far enough off the trail that I could only see patches of him through the trees, but those were impressive enough. His immense head, as long as a horse's body, rested deep in the moss. His single eye that I could see was closed, a great crest of feather scales, rainbow-hued, lay lax about his throat. Similar tufts above each eye looked almost comical, save that there could be nothing comical about a creature so immense and so strange. I saw a scaled shoulder, and winding between two trees, a length of tail. Old leaves were heaped about it, like a sort of nest. After a long, breathless moment, we exchanged glances. Ketrikin raised her eyebrows at me, but I deferred to her with a tiny shrug. I had no concept of what dangers it might present, or how to face them. Very slowly and silently, I drew my sword. It suddenly looked like a very silly weapon, as well face a bear with a table knife. I don't know how long our tableau held. It seemed an endless time. My muscles were beginning to ache with the strain of remaining motionless. The jeppas shifted impatiently, but held their places in line as long as Ketrikin kept their leader still. At last, Ketrikin made a small, silent motion, and slowly started our party forward again. When I could no longer see the slumbering beast, I began to breathe a bit easier. Just as quickly, reaction set in. My hand ached from gripping my sword hilt, and all my muscles suddenly went rubbery. I wiped my sweaty hair back from my face. I turned to exchange a relieved look with the fool, only to find him staring beyond me with unbelieving eyes. I turned hastily, and like flocking birds, the others mimed my gesture. Yet again we halted, silently transfixed, to stare at a sleeping dragon. This one sprawled in the deep shade of evergreen trees. Like the first, she nestled deep in moss and forest debris. But there the resemblance ended. Her long, sinuous tail was coiled and wrapped around her like a garland, and her smoothly scaled hide shone a rich, coppery brown. I could see wings folded tight to her narrow body. Her long neck was craned over her back like a sleeping goose's, and the shape of her head was bird-like also, even to a hawk-like beak. From the creature's brow spiraled up a shining horn, wickedly sharp at the tip. The four limbs folded beneath her put me more in mind of a hind than a lizard. To call both these creatures dragons seemed a contradiction. Yet I had no other word for beings such as these. Again, we stood silent and staring while the jeppas shifted restlessly. Abruptly, Ketrikin spoke. "I do not think they are living beings.
I think they are clever carvings of stone.
My wit sense told me otherwise.
They are alive.
I cautioned her in a whisper. I started to quest toward one, but Night Eyes near panicked. I drew my mind touch back.
They sleep very deeply, as if still hibernating from the cold winter, but I know they are alive.
While Ketrickin and I were speaking, Kettle went to decide it for herself.
I saw Ketrickin's eyes widen, and turned to look back at the dragon, fearing it was awakening.
Instead, I saw Kettle place her withered hand on the creature's still brow. Her hand seemed to tremble as she touched it, but then she smiled, almost sadly, and stroked her hand up the spiraling horn.
"So beautiful," she mused, "so cunningly wrought."
She turned back to us all.
"Mark how last year's vine twined about her tail-tip. See how deeply she lies in the fallen leaves of a score of years? Or perhaps a score of scores. Yet each tiny scale still gleams, so perfectly fashioned is she."
Starling and Ketrickin started forward with exclamations of wonder and delight, and were soon crouched by the sculpture, calling each other's attention to crafted detail after detail. The individual scales of each wing, the fluidly graceful looping of the tail coils, and every other marvel of the artist's design were admired. Yet, while they pointed and touched so avidly, the wolf and I held back. Hackles stood up all along Night Eye's back. He did not growl. Instead, he gave a whine so high it was almost like a whistle. After a moment, I realized the fool had not joined the others. I turned to find him regarding it from afar, as a miser might look on a pile of gold larger even than his dreams. There was the same sort of wideness to his eyes. Even his pale cheeks seemed to hold a rosy flush.
"Fitz, come and see. It is only cold stone, carved so well as to appear alive, and look! There is another with the antlers of a stag and the face of a man!"
Ketrickin lifted a hand to point, and I glimpsed yet another figure sprawled sleeping on the forest floor. They all departed the first effigy to regard this new one, exclaiming anew over the beauty and details of it. I moved myself forward on leaden feet. The wolf pressed tightly to my side. When I stood next to the horned one, I could see for myself the fuzzy sack of spiderwebs affixed to the hollow of one hoofed foot. The creature's ribs did not move with the pumping of any lungs, nor did I feel any body warmth at all. I finally forced myself to set a hand to the cold, carved stone. "It's a statue," I said aloud, as if to force myself to believe what my wit sense denied. I looked around me, past the stag man that Starling still admired, to where Kettle and Ketrickin stood smiling by yet another sculpture. Its boar-like body sprawled on its side, and the tusks that protruded from its snout were as long as I was tall. In all ways it resembled the forest pig that Night Eyes had killed, save for its immense size and the wings tucked close to its side.
"I spy at least a dozen of these things," the fool announced. "And behind those trees I found another carved column, such as we have seen before."
He set a curious hand to the skin of the sculpture, then almost winced away at the cold contact.
"I cannot believe they are lifeless stone," I told him.
"I, too, have never seen such realistic detail in a carving," he agreed.
I did not try to tell him he had misunderstood me. Instead, I stood pondering a thing. Here, I sensed life. But there was only cold stone under my hand. It had been the opposite with forged ones. Savage life obviously motivated their bodies, yet my wit sense regarded them as but cold stone. I groped for some sort of connection, but found only the odd comparison. I glanced about me, but found my companions scattered throughout the forest, moving from sculpture to sculpture,
and calling to one another in delight as they discovered new ones under clambering ivy or engulfed in fallen leaves. I drifted after them slowly. It seemed to me that this might be the destination marked on the map. It almost certainly was, if the old mapmaker had had his scale correct, and yet... why? What was important about these statues? The significance of the city I had seen at once. It might have been the original habitation of the Elderlings, but this? I hastened after Ketriken. I found her by a winged bull. He slept, legs folded under him, powerful shoulders bunched, heavy muzzle dropped to his knees. It was a perfect replica of a bull in every way, from its wide sweep of horns to its tufted tail. His cloven hooves were buried beneath the forest loam, but I did not doubt they were there. She had stretched her arms wide to span the sweep of his horns. Like all the others, he had wings folded in repose on his wide, black back. "May I see the map?" I asked her, and she started out of her reverie. "I have already checked it," she told me quietly. "I am convinced this is the marked area. We passed the remains of 2 stone bridges. That corresponds to what is shown on the map. And the marking on the column the fool found corresponds to one you copied in the city for this destination. I think we are on what was once the shore of a lake. That is how I've been reading the map, anyway. The shores of a lake." I nodded to myself as I considered what Verity's map had shown me. Perhaps. Perhaps it silted in and became swamp. But then, what do all these statues signify? She made a vague gesture around at the forest. A garden? Or park of some kind, perhaps? I looked around us and shook my head. Not like any garden I've ever seen. The statues seem random. Should not a garden possess unity and theme? At least, so Patience taught me. Here I see only sprawled statues with no sign of paths or beds or... Ketriken, are all the statues of sleeping creatures? She frowned to herself for a moment. I believe so. And I think that all are winged. Perhaps it is a graveyard, I ventured. Perhaps there are tombs beneath these creatures. Perhaps this is some strange heraldry, marking the burial places for different families. Ketriken looked about us, considering. Perhaps it is so. But why would that be marked on the map? Why would a garden? I countered. We spent the rest of the afternoon exploring the area. We found a great many more animals. There were all kinds, and a variety of styles, but all were winged and sleeping. And they had been here a very long time. A closer examination showed me that these great trees had grown around the statues. The statues had not been placed around them. Some were almost captured by the encroaching moss and leaf mold. Of one, little remained to be seen save a great toothed snout projecting from a boggy bit of ground. The bared teeth shone silver, and the tips were sharp. Yet I found not a single one with a chip or a crack. Everyone looks as perfect as the day it was created, nor can I decide how the colors were put to the stone. It does not feel like paint or stain, nor does it appear withered by the years. I was expounding my thoughts slowly to the others as we sat about our campfire that evening. I was trying to work Ketriken's comb through my wet hair. In the late afternoon I had slipped away from the others to wash thoroughly, for the first time since we had left Jampe. I had also attempted to wash out some of my clothes. When I returned to camp, I had found that all of the others had had much the same ideas. Kettle was moodily draping wet laundry on a dragon to dry. Ketriken's cheeks were pinker than usual, and she had rebraided her wet hair into a tight queue. Starling seemed to have forgotten her earlier anger at me. Indeed, she seemed to have forgotten entirely about the rest of us. She stared at the flames of the campfire, a musing look on her face, and I could almost see the tumbling words and notes as she fit them together. I wondered what it was like. If it was like solving the game puzzle that Kettle set for me, it seemed odd to watch her face, knowing a song was unfolding in her mind. Night Eyes came to lean his head against my knee.
"I do not like denning in the midst of these living stones,"
he confided to me. "It does seem as if at any moment they might awaken." I observed. Kettle had settled with a sigh to the earth beside me. She shook her old head slowly.
"I do not think so,"
she said quietly. She almost sounded as if she grieved.
"Well, as we cannot fathom their mystery, and what remains of the road has ended here, we shall leave them tomorrow and resume our journey,"
Ketrickin announced.
"What will you do?"
the fool asked quietly.
"If Verity is not at the last map destination?"
"I do not know,"
Ketrickin confided to us quietly.
"Nor shall I worry about it until it happens. I still have an action left to take. Until I have exhausted it, I shall not despair."
It struck me then that she spoke as if considering a game, with one final move left that might yet lead to victory. Then I decided that I had spent too much time focusing on Kettle's game problems. I yanked a last snarl from my hair and pulled it back into a tail.
"Come hunt with me before the last night is gone,"
the wolf suggested. "I think I shall hunt with Night Eyes tonight," I announced, as I stood and stretched. I raised one eyebrow at the fool, but he seemed lost in thought and made no response. As I stepped away from the fire, Ketrickin asked me,
"Are you safe alone?"
"We are far from the Skill Road. This has been the most peaceful day I've known in some time. In some ways."
"We may be far from the Skill Road, but we are still in the heart of a land once occupied by skill users. They have left their touch everywhere. You cannot say while you walk these hills that you are safe. You should not go alone."
Night Eyes whined, low in his throat, anxious to be gone. I longed to go hunt with him, to stalk and chase, to move through the night with no human thoughts. But I would not discount Kettle's warning.
"I'll go with him,"
Starling offered suddenly. She rose, dusting her hands on her hips. If anyone besides myself thought it was strange, no one made sign of it. I expected at least a mocking farewell from the fool, but he continued to gaze off into the darkness. I hoped he was not getting sick again.
"Do you mind if she goes with us?"
I asked Night Eyes. In reply, he gave a small sigh of resignation and trotted away from the fire. I followed him more slowly, and Starling followed me.
"Shouldn't we catch up with him?"
she asked me several minutes later. The forest and the deepening dusk were closing in around us. Night Eyes was nowhere to be seen, but then I did not need to see him. I spoke, not in a whisper, but very low.
"When we hunt, we move independently of one another. When one of us starts up some game, the other comes swiftly, either to intercept or to join in the chase."
My eyes had adjusted to the dark. Our quest led us away from the statues, into a forest night, innocent of man's workings. Spring smells were strong, and the songs of frogs and insects were all around us. I soon struck a game trail and began to move along it. Starling came behind me, not silently, but not awkwardly either. When one moves through the forest by day or by night, one can either move with it or against it. Some people know how to do it instinctively, others never learn. Starling moved with the forest, ducking under hanging branches and sidestepping others as we wove our way through the night. She did not try to force her way through the thickets we encountered, but turned her body to avoid being caught on the twiggy branches.
"You are so aware of her, you will not see a rabbit if you step on it,"
Night Eyes chided me. At that moment, a hare started from a bush right beside my path. I sprang after it, going doubled over to follow it on the game trail. It was far faster than I, but I knew it would most likely circle. I also knew that Night Eyes was also moving swiftly to intercept it. I heard Starling hurrying after me, but had no time to think of her, as I kept the rabbit in sight as it dodged around trees and under snags. Twice I nearly had it, and twice it doubled away from me. But the second time it doubled, it raced straight into the jaws of the wolf. He sprang, pinned it to the earth with his front paws, then seized its small skull in his jaws. As he stood, he gave it a sharp shake, snapping its neck. I was opening its belly and spilling its entrails out for the wolf when Starling caught up with us. Night Eyes snapped the guts up with relish. "Let's find another," he suggested, and moved swiftly off into the night. "He always gives up the meat to you like that?" Starling asked me. "He doesn't give it up. He lets me carry it. He knows that now is the best hunting, and so he hopes to kill again swiftly. If not, he knows I will keep meat safe for him, and that we will share later." I secured the dead rabbit to my belt. I started off through the night, the warm body flopping lightly against my thigh as I walked. "Oh." Starling followed. A short time later, as if in answer to something I'd said, she observed, "I do not find your wit bond with the wolf offensive."
"Neither do I,"
I replied quietly. Something in her choice of words nettled me. I continued to prowl along the trail, eyes and ears alert. I could hear the soft pad-pad-pad of Night Eye's feet off to my left and ahead of me. I hoped he would scare game toward us. A short time later, Starling added, "And I will stop calling the fool she, whatever I may suspect."
"That's good,"
I told her non-committally. I did not slow my pace. "I truly doubt you will be much good as a hunter this night. This is not of my choosing."
"I know. Do you want me to apologize as well?"
Starling asked, in a low, strained voice.
I
stammered, and fell silent, unsure of what this was all about.
"Very well, then,"
she said in an icily determined voice. "I apologize, Lord Fitzchivalry." I rounded on her. "Why are you doing this?" I demanded. I spoke in a normal voice. I could sense Night Eyes. He was already topping the hill, hunting alone now. "My Lady Queen bid me stop spreading discord within the company. She said that Lord Fitzchivalry carried many burdens I could not know of, and did not deserve to bear also my disapproval." She informed me carefully. I wondered when all this had come to pass, but dared not ask it. "None of this is necessary," I said quietly. I felt oddly shamed, like a spoiled child who had sulked until the other children gave in. I took a deep breath, determined to simply speak honestly and see what came of it.
"I do not know what made you withdraw your friendship, save that I disclosed my wit to you. Nor do I understand your suspicions of the fool, or why they seem to anger you. I hate this awkwardness between us. I wish we could be friends, as we were before."
"You do not despise me, then, for giving my witness that you claimed Molly's child as your get?" I groped inside me after the lost feelings. It had been long since I had even thought about it.
"Chade already knew of them," I said quietly. "He would have found a way, even if you had not existed. He is very resourceful. And I have come to understand that you do not live by the same rules that I do."
"I used to," she said softly. "A long time ago, before the keep was sacked and I was left for dead. After that it was hard to believe in the rules. Everything was taken from me. All that was good and beautiful and truthful was laid to waste by evil and lust and greed. No, by something even baser than lust and greed, some drive I could not even understand. Even while the raiders were raping me, they seemed to take no pleasure in it. At least, not the kind of pleasure. They mocked my pain and struggling. Those who watched were laughing as they waited. She was looking past me into the darkness of the past. I believe she spoke as much to herself as me, groping to understand something that defied meaning. It was as if they were driven, but not by any lust or greed that could be sated. It was a thing they could do to me, so they did it. I had always believed, perhaps childishly, that if you followed the rules, you would be protected, that things like that would not happen to you. Afterward, I felt tricked, foolish, gullible, that I had thought ideals could protect me. Honor and courtesy and justice, they are not real, Fitz. We all pretend to them and hold them up like shields. But they guard only against folk who carry the same shields. Against those who have discarded them, they are no shields at all, but only additional weapons to use against their victims. I felt dizzied for an instant. I had never heard a woman speak of something like that so dispassionately. Mostly it was not spoken of at all. The rapes that occurred during a raid, the pregnancies that might follow, even the children that six Dutchies women bore to the Red Ship raiders, were seldom spoken of as such. I suddenly realized we had been standing still a long time. The chill of the spring night was reaching me. "Let's go back to the camp," I suggested abruptly.
"No,"
she said flatly.
"Not yet. I fear I may cry, and if I do, I'd rather do it in the dark."
It was getting close to full dark. But I led her back to a wider game trail, and we found a log to sit down on. Around us, the frogs and insects filled the night with mating songs.
"Are you all right?"
I asked her after we had sat some time in the silence.
"No, I am not,"
she said shortly.
"I need to make you understand. I did not sell your child cheaply, Fitz. I did not betray you casually. At first I did not even think of it that way. Who would not want her daughter to become a princess and eventually a queen? Who would not want lovely clothes and a fine home for his child? I did not think that you or your woman would see it as a misfortune befalling her."
"Molly is my wife," I said quietly. But I truly believe she did not hear me.
"Then, even after I knew it would not please you, I did it anyway. Knowing it would buy me a place here, at your side, witnessing whatever it is you are going to do. Seeing strange sights no minstrel has ever sung of before, like those statues today. Because it was my only chance at a future. I must have a song. I must witness something that will assure me forever a place of honor among minstrels. Something that will guarantee me my soup and wine when I am too old to travel from keep to keep."
"Couldn't you have settled for a man to share your life? And children?" I asked quietly. "It seems to me you have no problem catching a man's eye. Surely there must be one that—"
"No man wants a barren woman to wed," she said.
Her voice went flat, losing its music.
"At the fall of Dimity Keep, Fitz, they left me for dead, and I lay there among the dead, sure that I would die soon. For I could not imagine continuing to live. Around me buildings were burning, and injured folk were screaming, and I could smell flesh scorching."
She stopped speaking. When she resumed, her voice was a bit more even.
"But I didn't die. My body was stronger than my will. On the second day I dragged myself to water. Some other survivors found me. I lived and was better off than many. Until 2 months later. By then I was sure that what had been done to me was worse than killing me. I knew I carried a child, fathered by one of those creatures. So I went to a healer, who gave me herbs that did not work. I went to her again, and she warned me, saying if they had not worked, then I had better leave it to happen. But I went to another healer, who gave me a different potion. It made me bleed. I shook the child loose from me, but the bleeding did not stop. I went back to the healers, both of them, but neither could help me. They said it would stop on its own in time. But the one told me that it was likely I would never have other children. Her voice tightened, then thickened. I know you think it slatternly, the way I am with men. But once you have been forced, it is different. Ever after, I say to myself, well, I know that it can happen to me at any time, so this way at least I decide with whom and when. There will never be children for me, and hence there will never be a permanent man. So why should I not take my pick of what I can have? You made me question that for a time, you know, until Moon's Eye. Moon's Eye proved me right again, and from Moon's Eye I came to Jampe, knowing that I was free to do whatever I must do to assure my own survival, for there will be no man and no children to look after me when I am old. Her voice went brittle and uneven as she said,
"Sometimes I think it were better had they forged me."
"No, never say that, never." I feared to touch her, but she turned suddenly, and burrowed her face against me. I put an arm around her and found her trembling. I felt compelled to confess my stupidity. I did not understand. When you said Burl's soldiers had raped some of the women, I did not know you had suffered that.
Oh.
Her voice was very small.
I thought you deemed it unimportant. I have heard it said in Faro that rape bothers only virgins and wives. I thought perhaps you felt that to one such as I, it was no more than my due.
Starling! I felt an irrational flash of anger that she could have believed me so heartless. Then I thought back. I had seen the bruises on her face. Why had I not guessed? I had never even spoken to her of how Burl had broken her fingers. I had assumed she had known how that had sickened me, but she knew it was Burl's threat of greater damage to her that had kept me leashed. I had thought that she withdrew friendship from me because of my wolf. What had she believed of my distance? "I have brought much pain into your life," I confessed. "Do not think I do not know the value of a minstrel's hands, or that I discount the violation of your body. If you wish to speak of it, I am ready to listen. Sometimes talking helps. Sometimes it does not," she countered. Her grip on me suddenly tightened.
"The day you stood before us all and spoke in detail of what Regal had done to you, I bled for you that day. It did not undo anything that was done to you, no. I do not want to talk about it,
or think about it." I lifted her hand and softly kissed the fingers that had been broken on my account. "I do not confuse what was done to you with who you are," I offered. "When I look at you, I see Starling Birdsong the minstrel." She nodded her face against me. And I knew it was as I surmised. She and I shared that fear. We would not live as victims. I said no more than that, but only sat there. It came to me again that even if we found Verity, even if by some miracle his return would shift the tides of war and make us victors, for some, the victory would come far too late. Mine had been a long and weary road, but I still dared to believe that, at the end of it,
there might be a life of my own choosing. Starling had not even that. No matter how far inland she might flee, she would never escape the war. I held her closer and felt her pain bleed over into me. After a time, her trembling stilled. "It's full dark," I said at last. "We had best go back to the camp." She sighed, but she straightened up. She took my hand. I started to lead her back to camp, but she tugged back on my hand.
"Be with me,"
she said simply.
"Just for here, and just for now.
With gentleness and friendship. To take the
other away. Give me that much of yourself."
I wanted her. I wanted her with a desperation that had nothing to do with love, and even, I believe, little to do with lust. She was warm and alive, and it would have been sweet and simple human comfort if I could have been with her and somehow arisen from it unchanged in how I thought of myself and what I felt for Molly. I would have done so. But what I felt for Molly was not something that was only for when we were together. I had given Molly that claim to me. I could not rescind it simply because we were apart for a time. I did not think there were words that could make Starling understand that in choosing Molly, I was not rejecting her. So instead I said, "Night Eyes comes. He has a rabbit." Starling stepped close to me. She ran a hand up my chest to the side of my neck. Her fingers traced the line of my jaw and caressed my mouth.
"Send him away,"
she said quietly. I could not send him far enough that he would not know everything of what we shared. I told her truthfully. Her hand on my face was suddenly still.
"Everything?"
she asked. Her voice was full of dismay. "Everything." He came and sat down beside us. Another rabbit dangled in his jaws. "We are wit-bonded. We share everything." She took her hand from my face and stood clear of me. She stared down at the dark shape of the wolf.
"Then, all I just told you,
he understands it in his own way. Not as another human would, but
how did Molly feel about that?"
she abruptly demanded. I took a sharp breath. I had not expected our conversation to take this turn. "She never knew," I told her. Night Eyes started back to the camp. I followed him more slowly. Behind me came Starling.
"And when she does know?"
Starling pressed. "She will just accept this
sharing?"
"Probably not," I muttered unwillingly. Why did Starling always make me think of things I had avoided considering?
"What if she forces you to choose between her and the wolf?"
I halted in my tracks for an instant. Then I started walking again, a bit faster. The question hung around me, but I refused to think about it. It could not be, it could never come to that. Yet a voice whispered inside me.
"If you tell Molly the truth, it will come to that.
It must."
"You are going to tell her, aren't you?"
Starling relentlessly asked me the one question I was hiding from.
"I don't know,"
I said grimly.
"Oh,"
she said. Then, after a time, she added,
"When a man says that, it usually means, 'No, I won't, but from time to time I'll toy with the idea, so I can pretend I eventually intend to do it.'
Would you please shut up?" There was no strength in my words. Starling followed me silently. After a time, she observed,
"I don't know who to pity, you or her."
"Both of us, perhaps," I suggested stonily. I wanted no more words about it.
The fool was on watch when we got back to camp. Kettle and Ketrickin were asleep.
"Good hunting?"
he asked in a comradely way as we approached. I shrugged. Night Eyes was already gnawing his way through the rabbit he had carried. He sprawled contentedly by the fool's feet. "Good enough." I held up the other rabbit. The fool took it from me and casually hung it from the tent pole.
"Breakfast,"
he told me calmly. His eyes darted to Starling's face, but if he could tell she had been weeping, he made no jest of it. I don't know what he read in my face, for he made no comment on it. She followed me into the tent. I pulled off my boots and sank gratefully into my bedding. When I felt her settle herself against my back a few moments later, I was not very surprised. I decided it meant she had forgiven me. It did not make it easy to fall asleep. But eventually, I did. I had set up my walls, but somehow I managed a dream of my very own. I dreamed that I sat by Molly's bed and watched over her as she and Nettle slept. The wolf was at my feet, while in the chimney corner the fool sat on a stool and nodded to himself, well pleased. Kettle's game cloth was spread on the table, but instead of stones, it had tiny statues of different dragons in white and black. The red stones were ships. And it was my move. I had the piece in my hand that could win the game. But I only wished to watch Molly sleep. It was almost a peaceful dream. 31. Elfbark. There are a number of old white prophecies that relate to the betrayal of the Catalyst. White Column says of this event, "By his love he is betrayed, and his love betrayed also." A lesser-known scribe and prophet, Gant the White, goes into more detail. "The heart of the Catalyst is bared to a trusted one. All confidence is given, and all confidence betrayed. The child of the Catalyst is given into his enemy's hands by one whose love and loyalty are above question." The other prophecies are more oblique, but in each case, the inference is that the Catalyst is betrayed by one who has his implicit trust. Early the next morning, as we ate toasted bits of rabbit meat, Ketrickin and I consulted her map again. We scarcely needed it any more. We both knew it so well. But it was a thing to set between us and point at as we discussed things. Ketrickin traced a fading line on the battered scroll. "We shall have to return to the column in the stone circle, and then follow the Skill Road for some little way beyond it. Right up to our final destination, I believe. I have no great wish to walk upon that road again," I told her honestly. "Even walking beside it strains me. But I suppose there is no help for it." "None that I can see." She was too preoccupied to offer much sympathy. I looked at the woman. The once gleaming blonde hair was a short, scruffy braid. Cold and wind had weathered her face, chapping her lips and etching fine lines at the corners of her eyes and mouth, to say nothing of the deeper worry lines in her brow and between her eyes. Her clothing was travel-stained and worn. The Queen of the Six Duchies could not even have passed muster as a chambermaid in Tradeford. I suddenly wanted to reach out to her. I could think of no way to do so, so I simply said, "We will get there, and we will find Verity." She lifted her eyes to meet mine. She tried to put faith into her gaze and voice as she said, "Yes, we will." I heard only courage. We had torn down and moved our camp so often, it no longer took any thought. We moved as a unit, almost as a single creature. Like a coterie, I thought to myself. Like a pack. Night Eyes corrected me. He came to push his head against my hand. I paused and scratched his ears and throat thoroughly. He closed his eyes and laid back his ears in pleasure.
If your mate makes you send me away, I shall miss this greatly. I won't let that happen. You believe she will make you choose. I refuse to think about it just now.
Ah.
He fell over on his side, then rolled to his back so I could scratch his belly. He bared his teeth in a wolfish smile.
You live in the now and refuse to think of what may come, but I find I can think of little else save what may come to be. These times have been good for me, my brother. Living with others, hunting together, sharing meat. But the howling bitch had it aright last night. Cubs are needed to make a pack, and your cub.
I cannot think of that just now. I must think only of what I must do today to survive, and all I must do before I can hope to go home.
Fitz, are you all right?
It was Starling, coming to take me by the elbow and give me a small shake. I looked at her, wakened from my bemusement. The howling bitch. I tried not to grin. I'm fine. I was with Night Eyes.
Oh.
She glanced down at the wolf, and I saw her struggle again to grasp just what we shared. Then she shrugged it off.
Ready to leave?
If everyone else is.
They seem to be.
She went to help Ketrickin load the final jepper. I glanced about for the fool and saw him sitting silently on top of his pack. His hand rested lightly upon one of the stone dragons, and he had a faraway look on his face. I walked up softly behind him.
Are you all right?
I asked quietly. He did not jump. He never startled. He just turned his pale gaze up to meet mine. The look of his face was a lost yearning with none of his usual sharp wit to it.
Fitz, have you ever felt you recalled something, but when you groped after it, there was nothing there?
Sometimes, I said. I think it happens to everyone.
No, this is different,
he insisted quietly.
Since I stood on that stone the day before yesterday, and suddenly glimpsed the old world that was here, I keep having odd half-memories. Like him.
He stroked the dragon's head gently, a lover's caress to the wedge-shaped reptilian head.
I can almost remember knowing him.
He suddenly fixed me with a pleading look.
What did you see back then?
I gave a small shrug.
It was like a market plaza,
with shops around it and folk plying their trades. A busy day.
Did you see me?
He asked very quietly. I'm not sure. I suddenly felt very uneasy speaking about it.
Where you were, there was someone else. She was like you in a way, no colour to her hair, and behaving, I think, as a jester.
You spoke of her crown, carved like rooster heads and tails.
Did I? Fitz, I can recall little of what I said immediately afterward. I only recall the feeling and how swiftly it faded. Briefly, I was connected to everything, part of it all. It was